Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This morning, President Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan, longtime general, strongman, and U.S. ally, took to the airwaves for over an hour to tell his countrymen he would resign.
Looking at all this situation and analyzing the situation after consulting my legal advisors and nearest political supporters, after consulting them and listening to their advice, in the interest of the nation, I resign from my post today.
He came to power in a coup. He leaves under threat of impeachment. He signed on with the U.S. for the war on terror, but never resolved his nuclear-armed nation's divided loyalties on the Taliban and al-Qaeda. This hour, On Point, Musharraf is out in Pakistan, and the questions are many. You can join the conversation. Is this a triumph for democracy, a turn toward hope, or chaos? Joining us first today from Islamabad is Candace Rondeau. She covers Pakistan for The Washington Post. Candace, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
How is Musharraf's resignation being received in Pakistan's capital?
Well, it's of course been received with great jubilation from many of the people here in Pakistan. We were out in the streets earlier today doing some interviews in the markets and also in the streets across from the Supreme Court where this battle really began for him a year ago. And universally people said that this was the start of something new, a new dawn in Pakistan. They were glad to see him go. But, of course, there are concerns. There's a new government that's got to take over now. And the unity of the coalition government, of course, is in question.
Pakistan is a nuclear-armed nation, famously. Who's in charge right now? Is Musharraf literally out? Will there be a transition period? Where does the ball stop? Who's head of state?
Well, he is, in fact, gone. Officially, the chairman of the Senate takes over and has done so as of just about an hour ago. They just announced it. And interestingly, he was actually acting prime minister, when Musharraf declared a state of emergency last year in November. As far as the nuclear issue, this is really an issue that the Pakistani military has control over. Generally speaking, I think the United States and other partners who have been looking at nuclear safety issues have said that everything is okay. They trust the military. They've got enough safeguards in place. Really, since Musharraf stepped down as chief of army staff, he really didn't have a hand in control over the nuclear missiles that Pakistan has gained over time. So ultimately, I don't think that's going to be a question. The bigger question here is, what's next, who's next, and how it will actually happen.
Candace, what about the United States' role, Washington's role, if any, in the departure of Musharraf? Of course, Pakistanis have led the way here, but what role has the United States played in recent weeks and months as he moved toward this decision?
Pakistani elites here have very strongly President Bush's.
It sounds like our line to Islamabad in Pakistan is breaking up. I want to thank Candace Rondeau with the Washington Post for joining us right there. We'll hear many more voices in this hour. Candace Rondeau, thanks to you in Islamabad, Pakistan. Joining me now in our studio is Adil Najam, Professor of International Relations and Director of the Pardee Center at Boston University. Adil Najam, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Listen back with me for just a moment, if you would. This is in January. Prime Minister, former Prime Minister, he who was essentially booted by Musharraf, Nawaz Sharif, speaking out against then-President Pervez Musharraf.
Musharraf must go immediately. He is the primary and principal source of discord in the country. He is a one-man calamity. He is responsible for all the trouble in Pakistan.
A one-man calamity, says, of course, his archenemy, the man that he booted out of office. How much truth in what Nawaz Sharif is saying here? Pakistan has a lot of problems. How much of it comes back to the years of Pervez Musharraf?
I think Nawaz Sharif was correct that by the time he makes that statement, Musharraf is immensely unpopular and he's really become a distraction from everything. I should also note that if any one person is more responsible for Musharraf's departure than everyone else, it's probably Nawaz Sharif. Asif Ali Zardari of the PPP would probably have lived on with Musharraf if push had come to shove. The US would probably have wanted that. The military would probably have wanted that. So Nawaz Sharif really pushed it as hard as anyone else, with the possible exception of the judges. But by the end of it, Musharraf had become the personification, rightly or wrongly, in some cases wrongly, of everything that was wrong in Pakistan. And there was just too much that was wrong in Pakistan.
We'll look at how this happened, but what's the lesson you take from the departure of Pervez Musharraf about military leadership in Pakistan, about Pakistan polity, what they want in their leader now?
Yeah, I think that there's also a global lesson. It's the lesson of arrogance. I think ultimately the real charge against Musharraf is the charge of arrogance. 9 years. This is a guy who I think, after his second year, could have had a real election and just swept away with immense popularity. This is a guy, I would argue, 2 years ago, before the Bukti killing, was actually probably very popular. And the last 2 years are a profile in arrogance, a profile in cutting yourself off from even wanting to hear what is just too obvious for the whole world to see.
He went after the judiciary, even the Chief Justice of the Pakistan Supreme Court, and bought himself a whole lot of trouble with that, with Pakistan's lawyers. We remember them on the streets. Of course, was in office when Benazir Bhutto was assassinated last December. He was now facing an impeachment campaign. Was there any way he could have stayed?
No. No, I think the most important thing that happened was, three things happened. One was that the political parties really played their cards very, very well. I mean, strategically, it was really brilliant. It's a textbook.
These two parties, one led by Nawaz Sharif, who we just heard there, the other led by the widower of Benazir Bhutto.
Yeah, who have nothing in common amongst themselves except a common dislike for General Musharraf. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they went to the four provincial assemblies, each one of which passed a resolution saying, we want you to be impeached. So essentially, they cornered him and said, there's no way you're getting out of this. But more importantly, what happened is Musharraf's two main backers both stepped back. That's the Pakistan military and the U.S. It isn't that they deserted him, but it is that they made clear that they were no more willing to bat for him. And because what has happened, I think, is that for both of them, the U.S. and the Pakistan military, the cost of keeping him in office had now become much more than any benefits that his staying there would have accrued.
And what comes now? Of course, no one knows. But does this present an optimistic scenario, a chance for rebirth? Or does this present the chance for chaos? We've heard the Taliban is rising. We know there's tremendous tensions politically within Pakistan. What are the prospects looking forward?
More uncertainty than certainty. Political uncertainty, political instability, but that doesn't mean that had he stayed, it wouldn't have happened. Things are not likely to get any better, but had he stayed, they would nearly certainly have gotten a lot worse. What you hear from Pakistan, what you hear on the streets, is a great and audible sense of relief. I don't think there's much joy, because everyone realizes this is going to get much worse before it gets any better. And part of that is this issue that the two parties are not natural allies. In some ways, I don't think it's even good for Pakistan's politics if they remain together, because, it becomes one party. They're the two largest parties.
Well, let's talk about that. We have the two parties here, that led by Nawaz Sharif, the Pakistan Muslim League, and the Pakistan People's Party, led by Benazir Bhutto's widower, Asif Ali Zardari. Coalition government, what does that mean in Pakistan? Has there ever been such a thing before?
I think there have been very few things like this anywhere in the world, certainly not in Pakistan.
Is this like Republicans and Democrats coming together or something?
Oh, Republicans
different?
And Democrats have far too much in common compared to these two.
It's more polar than that.
And that really is the story of General Musharraf. What they had in common was a very strong bond, and that was a common desire to remove Musharraf. And that's what held them together. And it's been amazing how they have been held together. They were both ousted in one way or the other, to one degree or the other, by Musharraf. And now that that common purpose, that mutual enemy is gone, the question is what will happen. And in some ways, their task becomes more difficult. Not only have they lost the common enemy, but they have lost the great excuse for everything that was going wrong. Musharraf has gone. Mm-hmm. High oil prices haven't. Massive increase in food prices hasn't. A massive energy crisis hasn't. Terrorism and fundamentalism and bombs on the street haven't. All of those problems will be there tomorrow morning, and they won't have Musharraf to kick around.
The great contradiction for the United States during these years was that Musharraf was formally and expensively a big ally in the war on terror and did assist the United States. But at the same time, Pakistan's intelligence services consistently supporting, it appeared, the Taliban, maybe even indirectly Al-Qaeda. Does that change now?
I'm not sure if they were supporting, but I don't think that will change. I think the biggest surprise, the people who will be surprised the most are maybe people in the U.S., because Musharraf had sold them this argument, and I think the U.S. was too gullible in buying it, that he was the last good Pakistani, that he was standing between this country full of really nasty people and chaos. And I think what we're going to find is that Pakistan's policy to the U.S. On the war on terror will not change in the least. Things will become, cooperation will become no less, but it can also become no more. The same reasons that compelled Musharraf to cooperate to the extent he did will remain there for the new setup, and the same reason that kept him from being able to do any more will keep the new apparatus from doing anymore.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Pakistanis there today celebrating the announcement of the resignation of President Pervez Musharraf. He was the general who took power in a coup in 1999, signed on with the American campaign against terrorism after 9/11. Today, under threat of impeachment, he is out. We're looking at his departure and what it means for Pakistan, for a very difficult, troubled region, and for U.S. interests there. I've been joined in the studio by Adil Najam of Boston University, an expert in international diplomacy and development, Pakistani himself. And now from East Hanover, New Jersey, by Azmat Hassan, Ambassador Hassan. He's professor at the Whitehead School of Diplomacy at Seton Hall University, former advisor to Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, former ambassador of Pakistan to Morocco, Syria, Lebanon, and Malaysia. Ambassador Hassan, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
So Musharraf is out. Are you celebrating?
I think many people in Pakistan are heaving a sigh of relief, and some of them may be celebrating because this is another juncture for Pakistan to pick up the pieces and to move towards a better future. It gives our politicians another chance to redeem themselves and to do better this time.
Better for whom? Better for the Pakistani people? Better for the international community?
I would say both. But as you know, the mandate for any party that comes into power democratically is to look out for its people, is to ensure that there is full employment, that the prices are reasonable, inflation is low, all the factors which lead to prosperity. And Pakistan has been in a spin, real spin, in the last year or 2 years, with all the economic indicators going south, moving downwards, and the pinch is being felt by the 170 million people of Pakistan. So I think the first mandate for this democratic coalition, which came into power last February, is to try to set the course properly and to see that Pakistan becomes economically stable as it was before.
Ambassador, can you explain for us, with this coalition government, first of all, does it look structurally stable? Does it look like it can last? Or does it inevitably dissolve into a competition? And we have these two strong leaders, one the former prime minister, Nawaz Sharif, the other the widower of Benazir Bhutto, Asif Ali Zardari. Does one of them become the next leader, or is it a third party? The dynamics of what's likely to happen now in Pakistani leadership, please.
These two parties are opposed to each other politically, according to the Western lexicon. One is center-right, that is the Nawaz Sharif party. The other party of the former prime minister, the assassinated prime minister Benazir Bhutto, whose husband is now, the temporary leader of the party, Mr. Zardari, that's supposed to be center-left. Well, these parties are quite different. And not only are they quite different politically, but there is a very strong personal element, personal animus, which informs them over the past 15, 20 years. Whenever one party has been in power, Nawaz Sharif was prime minister twice, Benazir Bhutto was prime minister twice. So they persecuted each other, they harassed each other, they hounded each other out. So there is a tremendous background which they have to cover of enmity, really, political enmity and even personal enmity. So I really don't see how that's going to happen very soon.
Adil Najam, I want to get you on that, but let's turn to our listeners as well. They're eager to join. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina, and Brian. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I am curious about the stability of this coalition, Nawaz Sharif, former exile, all that, and also Mr. Azari as well. I'm wondering that if Musharraf drops out and they don't have that common ground anymore, as you say, there is a potential for this coalition to break apart. And I'm curious, if that were to happen, who has the upper hand in this situation? Who has more political capital to handle the tumultuous climate of Pakistan post-Musharraf resignation?
Brian, and, thanks for that. We'll go to Adil Najam. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. Those are the easy questions. I think there's not only the potential but the likelihood of the coalition breaking apart. I think that will not be a bad thing. It is very clear that the senior partner, the party with greater seats, is the PPP, Asif Ali Zardari. I think more important is what is the
PPP,
term?
That's the Pakistan People's Party. That's for the Bhutto's party.
Bhutto's party. Mm-hmm. So they have more seats. They're clearly the government. The question really is, what is the term of that breakup? Is it an ugly breakup or is it a functional opposition, which I think will be good for the country? The challenge for Pakistan is that Musharraf had become extremely unpopular, but these parties haven't become any more popular than when they were. When Musharraf came, here's what the situation was. People were tired of the political parties. They thought they were corrupt, they were inept, they were incompetent, they were uninterested, they were personal aggrandizement and all that. In comes Musharraf with the slogan of Pakistan First. People say he's from the middle class, let's give him a chance. 9 years down the road, the only thing that has changed is not that people think that the political parties are any better, but that they realize that Musharraf was as bad as them. So what you have is this sense in the country that there isn't really groundswell support for any of these political parties. People will vote for them, but they don't have the confidence that makes them excited. That's the challenge for Zardari. That's the challenge for Nawaz Sharif.
Azmat Hassan, Ambassador Hassan, let me ask you, and I mean this with great respect, but here's a country full of very intelligent people who have made their mark all over the world, and yet after all these decades of Pakistani independence, there's a sense that there's something fundamentally troubled in this democracy, maybe in this economy as well, that Pakistan, well, in its neighbor India, seen as moving ahead with China in a very glossy fashion on the world stage, maybe Pakistan making some progress today as we speak. But is there something fundamentally out of kilter at the heart of this democracy that makes it so difficult? If so, what?
Well, that goes back really into the formation or the establishment of India and Pakistan as independent nations. Now, I don't want to make this very long, but Pakistan, as the smaller country, always felt insecure vis-a-vis India. And this goes back into history, into the history of the partition. And this meant that the Pakistan Army became empowered as early as 1952, 1953, 4 or 5 years after Pakistan's independence. And this kind of round table robin, which has been played alternating military rule with political parliamentary rule, has meant that the Pakistani politicians, A, do not have the confidence. They're always looking over their shoulder that the army could intervene or that they have to get the approval of the army in matters of national security. So if you compare Pakistan with India, India's had a much smoother ride. As the bigger country, democratic institutions were allowed to flourish. There was continuity. And I think it is this lack of continuity which leads the politicians to have the same type of maturity and the same amount of compromise and give and take, which are the bedrock of democracy. That has to be developed in Pakistan.
Adil Najam, do you think the military has learned a lesson from Musharraf's example? He struggled for a long time. He goes out in kind of ignominy here. The new general leader of the army, General Kayani, did not step in, though, by his not helping Musharraf. He made his mark here. But is the Pakistani military in the back seat for the moment?
The military always learns a lesson, but not for very long. The military has no appetite to jump in now. But does that mean they won't jump in the future? One can never say. The military has learned this lesson many times before. We've been here. It's Groundhog Day every day in Pakistan. What the ambassador was saying is exactly right. The habits of democracy are missing. I have been writing that unfortunately in Pakistan's history, there are only three ways for people to leave power, the three dreaded Ds. There's death, Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto. There's detention, Nawaz Sharif. Or there is disgrace, Benazir Bhutto.
Wow.
And one guy, Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, chose all three of them. Here is the tragedy of it. In some ways, even though Musharraf's exit has been in disgrace, it's one of the most dignified exits in Pakistan's history, apart from Ayub Khan.
Mark it up for progress of a sort.
He at least resigned. He wasn't booted out. He wasn't put in jail, which is how we usually change our leaders. That has to change.
And he's saying he's not leaving the country. He's saying he's not on a jet and out to exile.
I hope we'll talk about that, because I think that's one of the big questions, the terms of amnesty here.
We'll come to that. Let's take a call here from Jayanta in Mason City, Iowa. Hi, Jayanta. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I'm fine. I have a question, and I have some background to that question after the question. The question is it real, or is there any reason at all to worry about the uncertainty after the Musharraf's exit? And the question has the background that the Taliban regime started gaining control again during the Musharraf's time itself. And the other thing is now there's a division between the military and the civilian government. So now we probably is an opportunity to, you know, contain the military and make the civilian government so strong by U.S. support and the international community support that the military never, ever dares to dismiss a civilian government.
Well, good luck with that. But let us look at the Taliban piece of that question, if we may, Jayanta. And Ambassador Hassan, to you, the Taliban, of course, first routed by U.S. troops in neighboring Afghanistan, and then resurgent in recent years under Musharraf, the U.S. ally. Does that picture change with his resignation? Does that set the table for them to become stronger still, or somehow for that to be turned around?
Yes. Well, we have to go back to 2001 when the international community supported the United States' efforts to root out the Taliban regime, which had refused to give up Osama bin Laden, who had attacked the United States. I'm going to start from there. And my point, which I try to make whenever people ask me these questions, is that one of the mistakes made in 2001, the Taliban were removed from Kabul, but they were allowed to retreat to their stronghold in Kandahar in relatively good order. So they were not defeated. They were not defeated in the sense of Saddam Hussein's army.
Well, and then to retreat across the border into the sort of badlands of Pakistan itself.
Well, you know, that border is a porous border. I'm sorry to use that cliche, because the Pashtuns, the same ethnic people, live on both sides of the border. And for them, this border is meaningless. Somebody has a cousin on the Afghan side, somebody has an uncle or an aunt or on the other side. And the Pashtuns, if the Taliban are under pressure in Afghanistan, the Pakistani Pashtuns have a penchant for siding with their fellow ethnic group. You know, it's a question of kith and kin. And this explains why the Taliban were able to become resurgent. I don't think it was for lack of trying. President Musharraf may be in some disgrace today, but he did interject 80,000 Pakistani troops in the tribal areas and fought against the militants and the Arab fighters and the foreign elements there. And that fight is continuing. The Pakistan army engages them. But it's the combination of circumstances, the terrain, the fact that asymmetric warfare is now becoming a very effective tool in many war theaters. So these elements keep the Taliban very much there, and it depends on how they are tackled, not only militarily but politically, both in Afghanistan, where the real fighting is going on, and of course in Pakistan. And the coordination between Pakistan and Afghanistan at the political level has to be notched up, so that the militants are isolated and finally defeated.
Adil Najam, kith and kin across that border, yes. But Also, it has been said for a long time that Pakistan's intelligence services rather friendly toward the Taliban. The CIA got very tough just last month, saying there was evidence that the Pakistanis had been behind the July 7th attack on the Indian embassy in Kabul. Do you see a new dynamic with a new government, Musharraf out, that makes the so-called war on terror dynamic in Pakistan stronger or weaker?
Neither. It's going to remain as it is. It's going to remain an uneasy partnership. There's a lot of frustration in Washington, and there's a lot of frustration in Islamabad because neither of them has a strategy that seems to be working. And in the absence of that strategy, each tends to lash out on the other. I think there are lots of charges on General Musharraf which are correct. The one bum rap on him is that he didn't try hard enough on the war on terror. If anything, he might have tried too hard. The problem is any new dispensation, no matter who it is not going to be able to do any more than he did for exactly the same reason.
And those are?
Those are that it's very, very difficult to fight a war against your own people when you haven't first sold that as your war. Part of the problem is Pakistan has never owned the war on terror in general, and the U.S. has never owned the war on terror in Pakistan. They've both seen it as a mercenary transaction, as if somehow we've given you this money, you go and do this,
mm-hmm.
right? So there isn't that sort of groundswell. The bigger danger is that in the vacuum we've been talking about leadership, remember the Taliban today is a very different breed from the Taliban in Afghanistan. But what is common between the two is that both rise, not because someone supports them, but because there's a leadership vacuum. There was a leadership vacuum in Afghanistan after the Soviets left. And that is what led people to say, well, let's give these people a chance.
But what's been the leadership vacuum more recently?
In Pakistan, it is the exact thing we were talking about. General Musharraf's leadership sort of sliding down, no one really believing in him. The political parties there, but not really having that groundswell. And in that vacuum comes this Taliban dynamic. That's why it's very, very dangerous. That's why it's very important that the Taliban question or the fundamentalist question be really tackled as a priority regionally. That means Afghanistan has to be on the table, the U.S. has to be on the table, Pakistan has to be on the table, and the U.S. particularly has to tell the other two, guys, don't play us, don't play each other on our behalf. We have to do this strategy.
Easy
together.
To say, but hard to really stop. It seems like it's been going on for a long time. Ambassador Hassan, so there are some fundamentals here. What Adil Najam says may not change, but what about the instincts of potential successors or new leaders? When you look at Nawaz Sharif, when you look at Benazir Bhutto's widower, Asif Ali Zardari, do you see them as more or less interested in taking on the Taliban, in taking on Islamic extremism?
I think they would be definitely interested. But the major, the $64,000 question is that would they be any more successful than the Pakistan Army, than a former chief of the army staff? We should remember that President Musharraf combined both roles in his person until last November. And if, an army commando, leader of the Pakistan Army and president himself was not very successful or should have been more successful, then to expect Mr. Zardari and Mr. Nawaz Sharif, who are civilian leaders, to somehow produce the momentum which would defeat them militarily, I think, in my view, is a very tall
order. And it's not just a $64,000 question, Ambassador Saab. It's maybe a $6.4 billion question.
Or $10 billion.
if it were $64,000, we would pay up, I'm quite sure. The problem also is that they are democratic, and that means they are much more answerable to people's opinions.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf resigning. Longtime U.S. ally, headed out of office, under fire, just ahead of a big impeachment effort and a whole lot of unpopularity there. I've been joined by former Pakistani Ambassador Azmat Hassan. He's at Seton Hall University. Now he joins us from East Hanover, New Jersey, and in the studio by Adil Najam, Professor of International Relations at Boston University. Let's listen back on the sound of this relationship between Pakistan through Pervez Musharraf and the United States. Here he is, after 9/11, reaffirming his country's support for the United States at a joint press conference with President Bush, February 13, 2002.
I believe that Pakistan-United States relationship must draw strength from our past relationship as we move to a new century a changed world and meet the challenges faced ahead.
In March of 2006, President Bush still had strong words of praise for President Musharraf, the leader in which the U.S. had invested so much, and for his continued support of the U.S. in the war on terrorism.
President Musharraf made a bold decision for his people and for peace after September the 11th, when Pakistan chose to fight the terrorists. The American people appreciate your leadership, Mr. President, and so do I.
Appreciate your leadership. And now he's out. Let's go to our listeners, Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. You're on the air, Michael.
Hi. So I speak as a very frustrated, I guess informed at some level, and frustrated American for mm-hmm. all the money that we spend in Pakistan and lack of results. And what I'd like to ask your guests is, if they have if they had access to the levers of our power, democratic administration and military, what would they advise us to do militarily, monetarily, international diplomacy-wise to make to improve things there on behalf of Pakistani people and our local peaceful interests there?
Great question. Let me bring in another voice from Washington, where decisions like that get wrestled with, to look at it. Daniel Markey joins us. He's a senior fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Former member of the State Department's policy planning staff for South and Central Asia. Daniel Markey, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Our caller, Michael, looks back at the billions spent by the United States in Pakistan and feels very frustrated at the results. You know, he says, we'll put it to you, if you had the levers of power to from the position in Washington to do anything you could to help Pakistan, you know, move ahead for its own good and for U.S. interests there, what would you do now?
Well, I think it's perfectly understandable to be frustrated. I think everybody here in Washington is pretty frustrated. I think everybody within the Bush administration is probably pretty frustrated, too. If you had told people that in 2008 Osama bin Laden would still be at large, that the Taliban would be resurgent in Afghanistan, and that the situation looked like it was getting more unstable rather than less so, I think people would have been pretty surprised. So the level of frustration is high all around. The problem is that despite all this money that we're spending, the problems are much larger than the amount of money, the $10 billion or so that's been put out there as a figure, would suggest. We're talking about an entrenched network of terrorists, militants, and an underlying level of extremism throughout a tribal area that extends into Afghanistan, but in many ways is even more difficult to get at Pakistan. And we're talking about a challenge that can't be dealt with certainly by U.S. forces on the ground, because on-the-ground involvement by the United States and Pakistan would be, I think, disastrous. And we're talking about a partner that lacks a certain amount of capacity to deal with insurgency and terrorism, because their army and intelligence are not particularly well equipped to confront these tasks, and a country in which fomenting these kinds of insurgencies in their neighbors has been part of their national history for at least several decades now. So they're not it's not an easy partnership, but I guess what I would tell this caller and what I advise people here in Washington is, rather than seeing some sort of a quick magic bullet solution or throwing our hands up in despair, what we should really be doing is investing in a long term, and I'm talking now about at least a decade, probably significantly longer, investment in Pakistan and in our partnership with Pakistan. And to the extent that we can work with civilians alongside the Pakistani military and intelligence, we should be investing in those relationships as well. So I think this is going to be, I hope this will be at least number two on the agenda of foreign policy, national security items in the next White House.
Number two, you're talking right behind what, Iraq?
Iraq.
That's pretty high on the list. But you said, you began by saying, Daniel Markey, that the situation with Islamic extremists and militants is getting, as I heard you, more unstable in Pakistan. Paint that picture for us. What's happening to justify that statement?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the initial gains that were made in Afghanistan immediately after 9/11, when you had U.S. forces going in and working to clear out some of the training centers and so on that were based in Afghanistan, I think there was a belief at that time that initial push, followed up by several years of engagement in that country, would basically root out the problems of these terrorist training camps. What was not anticipated was that they would be able to, in many cases, regroup on the other side of the border in Pakistan. And then increasingly, even there, although they have been under some pressure from the Pakistani government, that they would link up with existing networks, both of militant groups that have for a long time been operating from the Pakistani side, and groups that used to be engaged more in the Kashmiri struggle, and sectarian groups, a variety of other networks that in many cases were actually built and funded, sustained by the Pakistani state for years as a means to project Pakistani power into India, into Kashmir, into Afghanistan. All of these things are now kind of coming together and getting increasingly troubling.
Adil Najam, how about it? Musharraf has been described in the hours since his resignation became apparent as having played a double game with the United States, signed on for the war on terror, and yet tolerated support for contrary interests. How do you see, going forward now, first of all, this big impulse of Islamic fundamentalism, extremism, which is alive and well in Pakistan, and the armed part of that, which relates to Pakistan's kind of under-the-covers game of regional influence that may or may not line up with its stated formal positions?
Michael's original question is frustrating for me for a different set of reasons. For the last 2 years, I haven't been...
You mean this question about what could the U.S., what should the U.S.
Yeah,
do?
But also this thing on, you know, we've given him this much money and so on and so forth. I'm not a Musharraf supporter for the last many years, but that one is a bum rap. In all the money we've spent on the war on terror, dollar for dollar, that $10 billion might have been amongst the best used money. If you actually look at all the money spent everywhere, he did actually deliver a number of key targets and stuff. The point I'm
targets
making,
as in people.
In people. And he did probably as much as he possibly could. The point I'm making is it will be not just naive but dangerous of us to assume that we can just pay someone X billion dollars and therefore they can clean up a mess.
Arrogant, maybe counterproductive.
Counterproductive. It won't serve our purpose. The same type of hurdles with all the money, with all the full control we have in Iraq and can't sort of stem that in a country like Pakistan becomes even more compounded. Daniel was right. You have to look not just simply at the dollar amount given to a particular entity, but at the longer-term strategy, and we really haven't had that. In terms of the issue that you mentioned, that's the critical question for the next government, for the current government in Pakistan, for Pakistani reasons. But this war on terror, cordoning it off only as a Pakistani or an ISI problem, I think is wrong and dangerous for the following reasons. The Taliban have risen partly because, yes, they had that the type of atmosphere in the tribal region where they could re-emerge. But it also happened because they were driven out and being allowed to come out of Afghanistan. It also happened because it was in the context of a larger set of war and terror, things happening in Iraq, things happening elsewhere. So assuming that Pakistan alone will be able to solve this, if we are only stern enough with them or if we are only generous enough with them, actually misses the point. Look here, the people who've been dying in Pakistan, there are more than thousands of people who have died in the war on terror in Pakistan, ordinary Pakistanis who get blown up. But we really don't talk of them as if they've died in our war on terror.
And you say, in fact, in a way, they have.
In every way, they are dead. Right? There's a kid there and someone blows him up and he's dead. We haven't owned them. The government of Pakistan, Musharraf, didn't own the war on terror and turn it into a Pakistani war. That's where the problem lies.
Ambassador Hassan, it was just about a year ago, July of last year, the whole world saw Pakistani troops storming the Red Mosque, a kind of center of Islamic radicalism in Islamabad. Scores died in that onslaught. Do you see a successor government to Musharraf as taking a tough position with Islamic fundamentalists, Islamic radicals, or as having to compromise with them? And how does that figure into the security picture in the region?
I was in Lahore when the Red Mosque incident was unraveling. I was teaching at the Lahore University of Management Sciences. And yes, I think that there was a tremendous failure of security in allowing militants to make the Red Mosque into a militant hideout and a militant fortress. And I think President Musharraf had no option but to use military force. Unfortunately, 100 people lost their lives, including men, women, and children. And this was a factor in his plummeting popularity, the ham-handed way in which this operation was handled. But it also shows that militant extremism is on the rise in Pakistan, which has been proved by attacks on the government in the north, in Swat, and certainly in the tribal areas, the situation has worsened. So I think I would agree with Mr. Adil Najm and, of course, with Daniel Markey, that what is required is a different strategy. Counter-terrorism alone will not work. Counter-terrorism is when you go after the bad guys with helicopter gunships, you bomb them, and, of course, there is a lot of collateral damage, which comes back to haunt you in a boomerang effect. What is required is a long-term plan to make the tribal areas, the people of the tribal areas, stakeholders, so that they do not go for the Taliban version of progress, of the future, and so on. The Taliban were in power for 5 years in Afghanistan, and they failed. There was tremendous fighting going on. There was tremendous insecurity all around. So I do not think that the tribal people would like the Taliban to come into power again to become a tremendous force, because they do not have any vision, any strategy. So we have to make them stakeholders by providing infrastructure, building their educational schools, giving them the wherewithal, and bringing them into the mainstream of Pakistan. I think the major failure of the Pakistani government, if you will, in the last 60 years or so, was that the tribal areas remained extremely neglected, out of the mainstream, and they were prone to all types of indoctrination and extremism.
Daniel Markey, let me just ask you, how do you think the United States then can combat the rise of the militant extremism, which Ambassador Hassan describes as still on the rise in Pakistan, or encourage the Pakistani government to do that without throwing gasoline on the fire?
Well, it's an extremely complicated process, and there's nothing that I can describe in 30 seconds, but I would say there's at least two prongs to this story that the United States needs to be engaged in. One is in support of the Pakistani government, the civilian government, and to win over sort of more of the Pakistani population to understanding the problem of militancy and extremism, terrorism, in a way that's similar to the way that we do. And one way to make Pakistanis more kind of sympathetic to the United States and to its project is by sort of assistance programming, economic development projects, diplomacy in support of this civilian government. I think all of those things will be significant and important and can go some way to convincing Pakistanis that we're not engaged in separate wars here, that our war is their war, and it's both against extremists and militants. The second prong of this approach, though, does have to be on the military and intelligence, policing, law enforcement side. And there, the Pakistani army and the frontier corps along in the tribal areas, the police in the settled areas just adjoining the tribal areas, need to be built up and turned into credible, effective counter-militancy, counter-insurgency operations, which they are not now. And there, that's also going to require, I think, U.S. assistance, training, involvement, and more closely that we can work with them to help them transform their security services into effective tools of counterinsurgency, the more rapidly that we'll make progress in those areas in fighting the sort of the worst of the worst, the armed militants, the Al-Qaeda sympathizers, and others. Both of those things, though, are going to take time, measured in years, not months. And we're going to be frustrated, I think, for at least the next 3 to 5 years.
Adil Najm with me here in the studio. We've just got another minute. Lots of callers we couldn't get to. A couple of calls here from Montreal in Canada, saying this is going to be the same old story all over again. Another saying you're too skeptical about this new coalition government. This can be different. How's your optimism-pessimism meter sitting today, Adil?
It can be different. I hope it is different. I pray it is different. I will dance in the streets if it is different. Nothing more I would like. So, but the probability is that the coalition, and I think the coalition understands this, has an uphill task. I think the people of Pakistan have an uphill task. Part of the problem is also, I think, the impatience with the messiness of democracy amongst ordinary Pakistani people. We get tired of things the first time something goes wrong. Countries like the US, others who have gone through democracy realize that there is a certain messiness. You don't like a guy, you wait 4 years, get the new guy in. And I think that habit of democracy hasn't happened. Very, very briefly, just to address one of the original questions you had asked, how will this new dispensation deal with terrorism? I think we are already seeing that in the last week. Musharraf hasn't really had any power the last many weeks. Mm-hmm. Right now, one of the largest operations is going on in the tribal areas. I think you will see no difference in that. And I hope and pray and wish that it will, in fact, be different.
The eyes of the world on Pakistan as Pervez Musharraf steps out of power. Adil Najam, thank you so much for being with us today. Ambassador Azmat Hassan at Seton Hall University, Ambassador, thank you for joining us. And Daniel Markey at the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Markey.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.